This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a series of interviews from our archives on religion and faith. Is it possible to be a feminist and a Catholic? How can you be faithful to your belief in equal rights while following a religion in which women cannot be ordained and cannot even use birth control? This is a question Mary Jo Weaver wrestles with. She is Catholic and a professor of religious studies and women's studies at Indiana University. Her book, New Catholic Women, examined how women were trying to change the patriarchal structure of the church. Her recent book, Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today, looked at women who are attempting to reform the church from within, and women who have left the church in despair and are seeking spiritual fulfillment elsewhere. Some of those who have left have gone to the other extreme and become goddess worshippers. Last year, I asked Weaver to explain why she's examining this form of neo-paganism.
I am most interested in the problem that women have with traditional religious formulations.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. I mean, if you have a religious need or a religious consciousness, okay, you need community, you need some sense of ultimacy, you need a location where religion can operate, if we define religion as a means of ultimate transformation. So you've got certain kinds of religious needs and desires, and at the same time, you have feminist identifications or needs and desires in terms of autonomy and freedom and so on and so forth. When you look around and try to see how you would combine those things, how would you bring your feminist needs and your religious needs together, I think some women have felt that they can't do that in any kind of traditional setting, that the only way to do that is to leave all kinds of traditional religion behind, Christian, Jewish, Catholic, whatever, and to go off and to find or to refind, create or recreate what they see as the most ancient religion of all, and that is goddess religion, that the original divine figures were maternal. There have been several books arguing that, these maternal, biophilic, peaceful societies existed in the ancient world. And so some women, I think, have been attracted to a religion for women or a religion with female divine figures. You're not going to find that in Judaism or the Catholic Church or traditional Christianity or Islam. So they go back to find it in goddess religion or what they think of as goddess religion.
How much of goddess worship do you think is based on rigorous history, and how much of it do you think is based more on wishful thinking or on a romantic view of the past?
The evidence that we have for these ancient matriarchies or for so-called goddess religion is pre-literate. That is, there are no texts. This is a kind of prehistorical moment. So people who are constructing or reconstructing goddess worship do it on the basis of pottery and sometimes on the basis of myths and legends and stuff like that. So its most vulnerable spot is its historical verification. It is not, in my opinion, a historical religion. Some critics have said it's a romantic recreation of the past. That might be. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I think there's a prejudice that a religion can only be genuine or only be good for people if it's historically verifiable. I think it's possible for people to be religiously happy with something that's not historically verifiable. I think there's a way in which myths and poetry and things like that can help us to rethink where we are now, and I think that's good.
Have you been to goddess rituals or ceremonies, and I wonder what's moved you or struck you from those?
I have not been to. I do not find that an attractive option for myself. And as I say in this book, I taught a course here a few years ago, and in a sort of half-hearted attempt to bring in the goddess perspective, I think I had, I did one reading or something like that, and I really think, I'd like to think of a way to put this on the air. I really blew it off in class. I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. I just sort of indicated that a lot of people were critical of this. And I had four or five students that were, they were angry. A couple of them were in tears. I'm trying to say to myself, what's going on here? What's going on here? And they were goddess worshipers, okay? I teach a course here on Christianity. I'm real sensitive to fundamentalist kids and to conservative Christians. And I know the sorts of things that upset them, and I don't tend to say that. But I think I wasn't prepared to see these goddess believers in my class. And because of that, and because of getting in conversations with them, I helped to put together a whole conference here at Indiana University on neo-paganism. And so I wrote that paper that's in my book on the goddess. But that is not out of personal desire. It was really an effort, I think, to be as fair as I could in looking at all the options that I could see.
Now, you've also written about women who are reinterpreting the religious text. Instead of forming like a new religion or going back to goddess worship, they're trying to just reinterpret the Bible and other religious texts to find more equality for women written within those texts? A better place for women?
It's kind of, you know, Mary Daly, I think, said a lot of years ago, if you took all the good parts of women out of the Bible and just put them into one little book, you'd have a pamphlet. it's hard to go back and take a book that has been shaped by cult and war and ritual and legalism that has purposely left women out and do much of a reinterpretation. On the other hand, critics like Phyllis Trible and people who work in biblical texts say that there's a lot more feminine imagery in the Bible than translators even allow for. You know, I mean, we're looking at a Bible in English because that's our language. When you go back and look up these words in Hebrew and so forth, apparently there's a lot more feminine resonance in some of those texts than we are led to believe. I'm still not sanguine about that as an option. I mean, I think we're probably, push comes to shove, going to find that this book is not particularly great for women.
What do you find most interesting on the revisionary front?
On the revisionary front right now, the most interesting book that's been written is a book by Elizabeth Johnson called She Who Is, arguing that we really have got that when the bottom line on all this stuff is the God symbol. And we have thought about God in exclusively male language and in masculine terms, king, warrior, lawgiver, he, him, and so on and so forth. Now, there are a group of people now who are arguing that that is a blasphemy, that really, if I can put it this way, gives God the short shrift, that basically metaphors about God are not God, they're just suggestions. We can never contain the divine in our language, and so we use our language to come up with what we think is the best approximation. And most language about God is anthropomorphic, that it's based on human experience and human symbols in some way. Well, the human symbols and human experience that have been exclusively used to talk about God are male or masculine. And so I think this argument would say what we want to do is to bring in symbols and experiences that are feminine, and that it's not good enough just to use the kind of language that never refers to God as he, using some kind of neutral language, but that in fact we really must refer to God as she and her will and so on, and him together, so that we come up with a much more balanced picture.
Do you ever think that it would be better to find some kind of neutral language to refer to God instead of he or she?
No.
God without gender? God transcending gender?
No, I don't really think so. Or, you know, as one of my graduate school professors used to say to me, when you're really in trouble, you don't say, oh, ground of my being, hasten to help me. You know, that these abstractions somehow take away from the central insight that we have about the deity, and that is that God has got a personality and is personally involved in our lives in one way or the other. And I think to constantly be referring to divinity, as I'm doing now, in these abstract kinds of terms rather than in more anthropomorphic language has got its own dangers.
Mm-hmm. Have you found a place for yourself within the church?
Myself? I find going to church sometimes profoundly uncomfortable, but that shouldn't be a huge problem. The language sometimes is bothersome to me, and sometimes it's not. I think I'm more bothered now by the fact that people seem to fiddle with the liturgy so much. You know, the it's very hard to, in my opinion at least, find a good liturgy that should waft you away and do certain things if you participate in it. Now I find it very kind of distracting. So my issues with the church are sometimes feminist, and they're sometimes really just more liturgical.
Well, you've described your own situation as one of spiritual homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't sure if you even go to church anymore.
Yes, I go to church, but I also am a kind of, I'm a pluralist person. I celebrate Passover with my surrogate family here, and I go to a lot of different churches. I go over to the AME church here 2 or 3 times a year. I go to the Catholic church. I think my connections with Catholicism probably are through, as it suggests in that book, through that kind of stream of religious experience that runs through what I think are the best parts of the Catholic mystical tradition.
How satisfying is it to go to services of different religions and different denominations as opposed to being affiliated with only one?
I feel affiliated with only one. Mm-hmm. That's not it. I mean, I think if you're my age and Catholic, it's probably hard to be anything else.
Yeah.
If you've, you know, this, I'm 50 years old, and being an ex-Catholic is probably not an option. And so I do not feel satisfied. I would not want to be anything besides what I am. I do, however, feel no constraints in terms of celebrating with other people in their traditions.
My guest is Mary Jo Weaver. She's a professor of religious studies and women's studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Jo Weaver. She's the author of Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today. Do you think that women have any hope of ordination within the Catholic Church?
No, I really don't. I keep trying. I gave the keynote address at the 10th anniversary of the Women's Ordination Conference, and my assessment of the historical situation then, which was 1985, remains the same. That is that women can stay in the church and wait to be ordained, and I don't see that happening in my lifetime. They can go to a Protestant church and be ordained and maybe not find a ministry. I don't know if they'll find that satisfying. Or they can basically try to respond to those communities that feel really still sacramental and in need of someone to celebrate with them and yet slightly off to the margins or askew or frankly, formally heretical to the Catholic Church and celebrate the Eucharist with them.
The most important woman in the imagery and symbolism of the Church is Mary. What are some of the controversies today over Mary's role in the church?
I think Mary, because we don't know anything about her really historically, except that she's the mother of Jesus. I mean, she's never mentioned by name in the New Testament, except in that context. And so where we don't know a lot, I think the imagination fills in. And I think the imagination fills in on the right and on the left as it has filled in through history. So in some sectors, Mary, I think, is a very conservative, if not reactionary, symbol. Various Marian apparitions, not just at Medjugorje in Europe, but also there are various Marian apparitions going on in this country right now, all over the United States at various sites. Most of the messages of those things are traditional and conservative. That is, Mary speaking against rock music, Mary speaking against abuses in the church, Mary speaking against abortion, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, I think on the left you have people who will take a text like the Magnificat in the Gospel of Luke, "My soul proclaims the greatness of the Lord. My spirit rejoices in God my Savior. He has raised up the lowly from the earth, and he has cast down the mighty," as a kind of text of liberation theology or empowerment. Mary becomes a figure in some communities of the unwed mother who was poor, and a serving woman, and kicked around, and misunderstood, and so on and so forth. So I think there's a whole sector there that can identify with her. I think there's a whole goddess motif around Mary, that a lot of the attributes of Mary in traditional Catholicism are rereadings or borrowings from certain kinds of things that we would find in the myth of Aphrodite or Venus or this or that or the other thing. I think in the traditional Catholic liturgy, there are all kinds of titles for Mary, you know, as Queen of Heaven and Tower of Ivory and Tower of David and things like that, that probably could be used, I think, to support Catholic women who are searching to find ways to maintain themselves and their feminism at the same time. So she's a very malleable, very plastic symbol, in my opinion.
You think of Jesus' attitude toward women as essentially positive and empowering. What have you found in the Bible that leads you to that conclusion?
Jesus treats women pretty much as equals. I mean, a normal man in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus probably shouldn't be speaking to women, should not be taking them particularly seriously, and should assume that they're going to sit home or stay home and cook and not do anything else. He's got these women followers. I mean, when he goes to the Samaritan woman, he goes and engages in a conversation with her that's kind of unheard of. He assumes that women are going to follow him or are going to be his disciples or are going to be empowering. If we look at a figure like Mary Magdalene, who has been used oftentimes by male interpreters as the figure of the prostitute or the, you know, the hysteric, something like that, let's look at that in a different way. I mean, what we have here is someone who's a friend of Jesus, the first person to whom he appeared. So in that way, the first of the apostles, someone who has got some clout and authority in the early church, it looks like, in one way, shape, or form. So I think there's a lot of positive things there.
What led you to studying theology as opposed to becoming trying to find a life within the church?
I did not study theology originally. I was a chemist, and I worked for a pharmaceutical chemical company for several years, and decided I did not want to do that forever. It was sort of an exalted way of being a cook, really, an organic chemist. So I wanted to go to graduate school, and this was right in the mid-60s when the council was just happening. I had always been interested in religion. I find the questions raised by religion in terms of culture and history and images and all those things fascinating. So I went back and got a PhD in theology after several years of working in a chemistry lab because I was interested in the questions. I've never been interested in any kind of professional life. I mean, I don't think I would want to be a priest, although I like preaching. I've done that a couple times, but I don't think I'm pastorally inclined. I like to teach, and I like to think, and I like to write.
Now, at what point did you also become interested in feminist issues, and what initial impact did that have on your religious studies?
I think if I had allowed myself to think much about feminist issues when I was a graduate student, I probably would have lost my mind. I was at Notre Dame, where I think there were 3 bathrooms for women on campus, and that's not a little teeny-weeny campus. And I just sort of went blissfully through that place not thinking about it and letting male professors say things like, well, we'll repeat this for Mary Jo because she really hasn't had that much Latin or stuff like that. I just didn't pay attention, period. And then my first job was in a seminary. I taught for 3 years in a seminary. And there, I think that atmosphere really was patriarchy at its finest in all kinds of ways, insidious and kind of sugar-coated and various ways. I was quite in tune with that. Then when I came to Indiana University in 1975, people ask me how I could possibly be a feminist and a Catholic at the same time.
What would you say?
I would say I don't know, but I can do it. I think it can be done. That's what really led to my first book, New Catholic Women, having these conversations with people here who said, well, how do you hold that together? How do people hold it together? See, I think there's some assumption here, oftentimes by liberals, that religion is something you can just sort of fop off. You know, religion is a pain in the neck. Therefore, I won't have anything to do with it. I won't practice it. I don't think one can do that so easily. I mean, literature hasn't been great for women, but you just can't throw it over and say, well, that's it. There is no literature. History hasn't been great for women. You can't just throw it over. I don't think you can just throw over religion either. So I've been a lot more interested all the time in trying to see how you could make these things work together. And if it doesn't look like it can work together in the structure, then what can you do in your own life to enhance your religious life without selling out your feminist principles?
I know one of the women in Catholicism that has meant a lot to you is Teresa of Avila. I don't really know anything about her. Tell me something about her and what you've found in her story that resonates with you.
Teresa of Avila is a 16th century Spanish nun, a Carmelite, who probably led a jolly little life for a while and then had some kind of illness or something. I don't really know a whole lot about her I don't think much about her personal story. Her personal story doesn't interest me. She became a reformer, and she did all these kind of reforms in the Carmelite order. What's important about Teresa for me is that she, in her contemplative experience, she's a mystic and a contemplative. She's got a kind of prayer of quiet. In Teresa of Avila's prayer, in her understanding of God, God is located inside the self, at the deepest center of our self, waiting for us to get in touch, as it were. And that we find God in ourselves by way of quiet prayer and contemplation. We don't have to be doing all these other kinds of things. And this God at the center of ourselves is passionately loving and affirming and cares about us, and really is just longing for relationship with us, as we, in fact, should be longing for relationship with God. So that's Teresa's, I think, major insight is that God within us, and that's what's attracted me to it.
I guess that relates to what you were saying before, that you were interested in the mystical stream.
Yeah, that's it. That's been my way to sort of, if I don't agree with or find myself put in a quandary by what a particular bishop says, what the Pope says, and so forth, I think I find in contemplative prayer and in the mystical streams of Catholicism a retreat, a place to go, and a place to get myself refreshed.
Mary Jo Weaver is the author of Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today. She's a professor of religion and women's studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.